Welcome back to Tech Days Online, turning data into intelligence. I'm joined by Richard Conway. And Richard, you're an RD. What is that?
I am indeed. So I'm a Microsoft Regional Director. It's a very special title, and it's a very sort of community and technically and business-focused role and all of these sorts of things where I help set up community events and I really keep my finger on the pulse of technology, and it's a great boon because I get to talk to some amazing people in Microsoft about all the technologies that I love.
Marvellous. Well, thanks for taking time out of your very busy schedule. We're pretty lucky to get this guy on the show, and we've given you the tough topic of the day: big data, Richard.
Big data. Oh, so much to say about this. We're probably not going to fit all of this material into 45 minutes. But let's start. Before we actually start, Andrew, I did want to make a few sort of announcements and just let people know about some of the great stuff that we're doing and how they can learn more about this topic. So there's a little bit of information about me, but in really taking this appreciation of Azure, we founded the UK Azure User Group. So, you know, obviously it's great to be here and tell people about some of the great meetups that we put on.
And you've got Scott Goo here?
We have, indeed. We've got Scott Guthrie here, who's an EVP in Microsoft, and he owns server and cloud. So he's entirely responsible for Azure and made it the great platform that it is currently. So we have Scott for a day in London. So if you're in London on June the 3rd and you want to have a whistle-stop tour of Azure and you want to hear Scott do a morning keynote, you want to hear some great talks in the afternoon about some of the amazing new technologies that are surfacing in Azure, like Service Fabric and Internet of Things and Big Data, then you know, absolutely come to this conference. We'd love to see you. It's free for the day. We'll ply you with coffee all day, we'll feed you, and we're going to have a hackathon as well, so you can actually get hands-on and do all of these things. But if that wasn't enough, we are also going to do a second day. And yes, this is Thames Valley Park. This is Microsoft HQ, absolutely. So we've been working, the community has been working really hard with Microsoft to do an event like we've never done before. So normally we do developer events, we run hackathons. You know, because of our love for data, we tend to do a lot of events which are data-centric. But we thought, you know what, and this is sort of given away by the title Azure Craft, why don't we couple two things that developers love, Azure and Minecraft, that kids love, and that the kids love. So we decided to put together Azure Craft, and on the second day we're running some amazing things. You know, we're teaching Minecraft through the microbit. We've got this big focus on nanosatellites, an incredible project and initiative that's being run out of Microsoft UK, and is really taking shape at the moment. So we're going to have some great time here. But we really want to empower families and children to really use and relate to the cloud with this.
Yeah, you've got to try the stuff. And there's only so much you can do watching a video. It's a bit like learning to drive, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right, so thanks for the advertorial. Let's get on with the show.
Absolutely, let's do it. So I want to start. I know we had an impromptu definition before. And we'll just start with this idea. We'll recap with this idea of the three V's, which is this talk is about big data, and this is really how people are defining this, you know, through volume, because we've amassed so much data over the long term. And, you know, as Matthew pointed out, he brought this really home in a very sort of conceptual level about what these terms mean. But what this means for a business, this volume, is, you know, 10 years worth of weblogs, for example, you know? And what is this? This is, you know, 50 terabytes, 100 terabytes of data. You know, to literally be able to trawl through this in a relational database is impossible.
Yeah.
So big data is all about appreciation of these things. Then you've got this idea of variety. You know, as enterprises emerge, what tends to happen is we get you know, different projects at different times, different eras, relating to different technologies with different file formats. And, you know, we end up in a position where we've got all of these different schemas and we don't really understand what they are.
And running SQL over a collection of photographs isn't going to work, is it? Or sound files or JSON objects, even JSON, if we loaded it in. I mean, I know it can be super hard to understand that stuff. And of course, it's coming out as fast as our network can cope with sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, and the speed of this, you know, if we used a lot of the technologies that we use today, we can't do this fast enough, you know? So applying these three Vs is a really simple way of breaking down this problem, you know, a set of desired outcomes that we want from a solution, which is where this ideal of big data takes over. But if we think about, you know, what has changed in data, the Apollo mission, right? We were talking about, you know, 64 kilobyte payloads and 64K buffers. So computing was very different then. We were talking about, you know, we weren't talking about very large storage devices. We weren't talking about large compute devices. And if we fast forward, right, just the mass of Halo health messages with the Xbox game, you know, we're talking about gigabytes of data per second. So, you know, that change in time, that whole change in... you know, in this information superhighway has necessitated a different set of technologies over, you know, literally 50 or so years, less than 50 years. So we do live in crazy times, I think. So, you know, I think where we start this is, you know, when you speak to companies, you really get that, you know, idea of boundaries, complexities, you know, incumbent systems with their relational data. And, you know, where you start the conversation of big data, it's about unlocking some of the potential and moving away from very schematized systems, you know, which are heavily normalized. And so these are the sorts of conversations that you'll find in the office with DBA, solving problems around the storage and the access times with data. So, you know, there are some simple things that we can define that we want to achieve through this. You know, we want to discover what we don't know from the data. Sometimes with the with the systems that we have, it's very easy to ask questions that we do know with expectations and answers that
and we're typically getting that answer back, I guess, in a two or at least a three-dimensional array, either as a visualization or as a grid of numbers. But if you've got, we've just been talking about meningitis, if you've got 20 characteristics that relate to meningitis, it's very difficult to conceptualize that in the human mind. We can't think in 20 dimensions. So you want to move away from eyeballing the numbers and get, as Matt was saying, the algorithms to kind of play with this, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, this is where I see, you know, the cloud and Microsoft's biggest value, and we'll talk about that as we go along. But, you know, that enablement cycle so that you can just go to the root of the problem. This idea about actionable insights that we hear about all the time. You know, you can skip the management of the infrastructure and, you know, and being able to actually understand what these systems do, because Microsoft has done so much work to just give you these and give you a set of very simple interfaces that will drive your uses and your use cases. And, you know, and as we move through this cycle, we begin to understand patterns and practices around big data. You know, a lot of companies think that their approach to data is, you know, unique. They have a unique use case, and many do. But what you'll find is that there are some well-pronounced patterns that Microsoft has discovered over years, and they can tell you how to do this.
Yeah, and I think in one case you're working on, you were taking something that we'd normally associate customer churn with retail. But what if we use the same algorithms against education and looked at student dropout rates,
Absolutely.
For example? You know, and I think that everybody thinks they've got, this unique perspective. And I guess one of the other things that's unlocked this problem now is that people are much better at sharing the ideas and the techniques they've used through code on GitHub or algorithms on CRAN, on R, and so that hopefully then the business, it needs to percolate up to the business level now, that someone may have already done some work in this space.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that you're getting a lot of communities forming around this because techies are really attracted to these technologies, you know, because they've got amazing potential.
Super fun stuff to play with,
So, I just wanted to bring down who the users are of these technologies. So so this is
a great definition.
Yeah, Josh Wills from Cloudera, who gives a definition of a data scientist, a person who is better at statistics than any software engineer and better at software engineering than any statistician. So I think as we sort of move through this big data landscape, you know, we're getting the development of careers and people and understandings which involve small bits of engineering, small bits of mathematics, small bits of design, you know, so they're not experts in any one thing, but you need these things for the big data technologies to work properly. So we like that. And just to show you the breadth of what big data actually means, this is a quote from Jeff Hammerbacker from Facebook. On any given day, a team member could author a multi-stage processing pipeline in Python, design a hypothesis solution, perform a regression analysis over data samples with R, design and implement an algorithm for some data-intensive product or service in Hadoop, or communicate the results of our analyses to other members of the organization, possibly through a visualization.
And the story I like to tell on here is the one inside Microsoft with what we have was this engine called Cosmos. And that's our internal engine that sits behind Bing and MSN. And it wasn't working as well as it was, brutally honest. So what do we do? Oh, well, let's go and hire some people in. Well, that didn't really work because those data scientist people were spending too much time fiddling around with the data, not actually coming up with the tests and so on and the insights that we're expecting. So we had to redesign the whole system. And actually, that's what bore out, that's where the Cosmos system came from. And then we thought, that's such a good idea. Well, if we, you know, we then need to make that into production. So how do we put it in production? We do what any modern business should do, is put it in the cloud. In Microsoft, we'd put that on Azure. So if we can put Cosmos on Azure, fantastic. And then somebody in marketing has a bright idea. Well, if it's on Azure, maybe we could market it and sell it to other people. So we have this data lake now, and that's pretty much what it is. And Scope was the language, and now we have USQL as the language. But the point being is that we want to basically make the tooling a little easier, as well as having that scale and performance that we need.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I think this is one of the appeal of Microsoft technologies. You know, several years ago, we started doing hackathons for data scientists with our community, and we didn't have all these amazing tools like Azure ML. And you know, Microsoft Research were providing toolkits. It was a very, very academic working place. And then all of that technology found its way into the mainstream, and people began to use it.
Yeah.
So, and it makes life much easier because you can focus on the problem domain.
Right, so it's important stuff, and I think this is super important as well.
Yes.
This idea between batch and speed.
Yeah, exactly. So, so one of the things that you'll find is that Azure has an answer for everything, and there's many different ways to skin a cat. But I wanted to show this because as a pattern of reuse, we've used this all over the place. We use this for community projects.
Yeah.
We use this for. You know, for some of the projects we do for customers, and you know, it's essentially being able to take telemetry or data ingest from some system, republish this out. So there's a messaging mechanism in Azure called the Service Bus and the Event Hub. We can either persist these, so we can have a long-term view of storage, and we can push these into Azure storage. We can schedule. Hadoop jobs, and we'll talk about Hadoop in a bit. Or we can process singular messages in real time. So we've got a couple of different options as to how we view this data. We can view it as a time series so that we can see this data coming in. We can spot trends in real time. We can react to events, the so-called complex event processing. And then we can use our familiar SQL to deliver this to people.
Yes, yeah, so SQL now for me really becomes a query language rather than being locked into this world of relational databases and transactions and so on.
Absolutely. So let's talk a little bit about Hadoop and specifically about HD Insight, which is Microsoft's Hadoop implementation in Azure. So you can see this is a very, very large diagram which sort of defines how Microsoft view Hadoop. Sorry for the incredibly garish colors.
That's okay. It's very readable.
Okay. So you can see there's a lot going on in this system. Mm. You've got multiple languages, you've got multiple frameworks, you've got this idea of MapReduce, which we're going to look at, you've got HDFS, which we'll discuss, and all of these different things going on. And they sort of marry themselves very well to the converse picture, which is the Apache ecosystem.
So,
you know, one of the things that I noticed in front here is Tux the penguin.
Yeah, penguin guy here.
Let's hold Tux up. Fantastic. So, you know, for me, this is the embodiment of the new Microsoft.
Yes.
Because with Hadoop, what Microsoft has done is they've taken a collection of what started out to be community or Apache projects that have now turned into things that many companies are using. And, you know, they've turned them into something that can be reused with the minimum of effort. So you don't need to worry about the deployment. You don't need to worry about the underlying infrastructure. Microsoft will do it for you.
Yeah, I mean, it is bewildering to see this list. How do you fit all of this stuff together? And I think if you come from this traditional BI analytics world, and I see a lot of people going on that journey, and then over here you've got these people who've been playing in this world, and there's this sort of like buffer here now, and these guys are having to spend quite a lot of cycles spinning up this infrastructure before they can actually start working on the problem. And that's why we have people like Cloudera and Hortonworks layering on top of this to make that easier to do. But we've done that too on Azure, and that's essentially what HD Insight is. So you can have flavors of Hadoop, which is the earlier diagram we saw, if I've got that right.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's really interesting because in the early days, when we just had virtual machines, we tried to do this ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
It takes a very long time.
And
part of the problem is that this software changes so regularly that, you know, to keep updated with the latest version of software, especially in the case of Apache Spark, which is one of my favorites. It's on the diagram. It's the with the orange star.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, to keep up with the updates, which can sometimes happen like every week or every 2 weeks, and there are pretty intense changes in the software, you know, you don't want to do this yourself. You know,
it's, and it can break, obviously, what you already have in place because there's going to be orchestration maybe going on in Mahout. There's going to be... The tooling that you're using, the scripts that you have, could break because the functionality could be deprecated or there's a new name for it. And then there's suddenly something that was really hard to just get super easy and you didn't know about that.
Exactly.
So you're not able to leverage it as much as you'd want to.
And that and it's a real boon to just have this capability as a platform service where you can just leave it to Microsoft to spin up a cluster, a Hadoop cluster, and just execute some software and get a result, which is really what you want to do anyway.
Yeah, and that was one, I think, one of the challenges we faced actually when we first started trying to keep this up, of course, is that Hadoop was running on Windows, and so it's always going to be slightly lagging what's on what's happening on Linux. And now we've got HD Insight actually runs on Linux as well. If you want it, you can choose when you spin it up, and it's far more, it's far easier to port what you may have already originally done with that platform.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that it also resonates with a lot of existing users of Hadoop because, you know, they started out life with using Hadoop on Linux. It's a very, it's a set of open source tooling. So Java developers, you know, Java's a very, very good skill for this because natively most of the Apache frameworks are written in Java. And this, you know, I think the way that, that Microsoft has embraced these languages has been fantastic, you know, all the way down to being able to deploy things directly onto Hadoop clusters from environments that are not Visual Studio. So from IntelliJ, from Eclipse, you have all the appropriate plugins to just say, I'm going to write a Hadoop, a piece of software for Hadoop or Apache Spark or Storm. I'm going to right click on this piece of software and then I'm just going to deploy this straight to Azure.
And for the people who are the Microsoft fans, and I presume they're on Channel 9, so they might be, we've got good tooling as well for the traditional Microsoft audience
too. And you can do this straight from Visual Studio. I think that, you know, not to mention the fact that Microsoft have put a lot of energy and effort and guidance around, you know, around how to use C# as a language with Hadoop. And in Storm, there's a, we'll touch on Storm later on, but there's a framework that you can use with Apache Storm called SCP, which allows you to write in C#.
Wow, okay.
So, lots of amazing innovations.
You can zero in on a problem. You don't have to learn a new language, but you do need to know some languages.
Yeah.
I mean, to your point earlier about the data scientists, it's just you don't need to learn a new one.
Yeah, that's right.
Fantastic.
Exactly. So this is now HD Insight.
My favourite thing on there as well, that
R server. I put that on there especially for you, Andrew.
Thank you.
It's worth talking about the story of this. So Hadoop, we've touched on, we'll touch on how that works. there's a piece of software that runs on HD Insight called HBase, which is a petabyte scale column store. So, so we can use this almost like a NoSQL database directly from Hadoop to store our state. We've got Storm, which processes messages in real time, and it can, you know, HD Insight Storm syncs up really well with other services like the Event Hub. So you can feed in thousands of messages a second.
So to characterize this, if I've got this right, HBase makes Hadoop look a little bit like a relational database. Mm-hmm. Would that be fair? Storm is where we want to use the real time kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And we'll come back and look at each of these in a bit more detail. It's your favorite thing is Spark. And what is that all about, Richard?
So one of the things that people call Apache Spark is the Swiss Army knife of big data.
Right.
So it will give you a flavor of what it is. But with Spark, what you can do is you can do many of the things that you can do with Hadoop. You can also run interactive queries. Which is very difficult with Hadoop.
Yeah, so normally you're running a big job. So although it looks a bit like SQL, HQL looks a bit like SQL, you might have to go and have coffee while the answer comes back, because it's, you know, you've orchestrated this 500 node. I know you've worked on a 500 node HD Insight cluster.
Right.
And that's going to take a while, right?
Yeah.
And I also, for me as an rank amateur, when I do a demo, you know, I'm going to calculate pi or some simple calculation, I think I've spent all this infrastructure and it's taking me way longer than it would have done on my calculator. But of course, the point is it's designed to scale, and it really takes off when it scales. So Spark enables us to do this real-time thing. That's going to be super popular.
Yeah. So it has an interface called Spark Streaming, and it also has a machine learning library. So you can use Spark ML to actually distribute machine learning code.
And is there a special name for that Spark R? Is it just called Spark R?
So Spark ML and Spark R also is available. Right. So you can write this code in R on Spark.
But we've also got this thing on the right here.
Yes, this
so I'm thoroughly confused now.
This is slowly becoming my second favorite.
Okay.
So one of the things that the Microsoft did was to buy out a company called Revolution Analytics. Yeah. And what Revolution Analytics did was effectively create a speedy version of R. So
scalable version of R.
Yeah, exactly. So, R has a lot of problems in its threading model. So you can't run this in a multi-threaded, multi-process environment.
Right.
And you can't run it in a distributed environment. So so Microsoft has been solving these problems with Revolution. And also making this a first-class citizen of Azure.
Yeah, yeah. And there are investments all over the Azure ecosystem. We'll be touching on that as a continuing theme. I think just for a brief diversion there, obviously one of the other questions I get asked a lot is Python versus R. And of course, that's not really a Microsoft fight because neither of those are Microsoft languages. But I guess Python already had some of that scalability and parallelism built into it. And so the algorithms that were traditionally associated with R have been put into Python. Mm. But equally, R's moved up and already had all this really good ML stuff built into it. And Revolution makes it behave like Python. So I think it ultimately, for me, and I hope you agree with me, is use what you know.
Yeah.
And we've got really good tooling for both.
Exactly. So, I mean, it's, I think, one of the things that that Python has, that's emerged with Python in the big data space is, there's a tool that you can use called Jupyter Notebooks.
Yes.
And Jupyter Notebooks promotes this idea of reuse. So you can create a notebook and then you can distribute this to other people. So it's a very good learning aid for Python. So I think a lot of people have been learning from this. Mm-hmm. And you know, the great thing about it is that you can use libraries like Pandas to use data frames to basically take in-memory data sets to pivot them, to manipulate them, to add columns to them, to remove columns, to transform them between different data sets. And, you know, with a little bit of effort, you can distribute this as well. Now, the Jupyter Notebooks is supported through HD Insight.
Yep.
So you can run this on a Spark cluster. But it's also supported through Azure ML. So there's lots of different ways to use Python in the Azure ecosystem. I think that, you know, as you rightly said, R has really had a head start. You know, the entire academic community has been behind this. It's got some of the most phenomenal machine learning libraries, libraries for every line of business as well, for economics statistics, for energy statistics, for time series analysis. And so, you know, you're not starting from scratch with R.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so we've got all of this goodness built in just when we turn this thing on.
Yeah. And this is click a button and it's there. Automate it and it's there. So you've got full command and control over this framework. So what is this? You've got a set of different tools that you can use. You can use Mahout, you mentioned that before, or Mahout, two ways of saying this.
I've upset somebody now.
Probably. Which will allow us to do machine learning over a Hadoop cluster, Giraffe, which is a way of a graph engine, so it will allow us to take data in Hadoop and turn this into a graph, basically, so we can understand the edges and
all graph of the different databases.
We've got several languages that we can use, Pig, Hive, and .NET. And one of the innovations that Microsoft has brought to Hadoop through HD Insight is to externalize the storage. Because Hadoop uses a distributed filing system called HDFS. And HDFS is reliant on the disks.
Yep.
So it's one of the things that you find with the cloud is that you don't need things running 24/7.
No.
So Hadoop is effectively a managed service. HD Insight is a managed service of Hadoop, right? We only want this for a few hours a day or when we want to do work.
But if you turn it off, we're persisting the data when the cluster's turned off.
Exactly. And that's really where the innovations come in, to externalize the storage into Azure storage.
And I think one of the things we've got on here is Azure Blob Storage. And of course, what we actually have now is this data. I talked about Cosmos earlier. We have this data lake storage now. And that should be the way, if you're just starting out today to play with this, that should be where we use, that should be the landing place for our data, because it doesn't suffer some of the limitations that exist with Azure Blob Storage with scale, how many objects we can put in a store, and then and I know you've hit this barrier with some of the projects you've been working on.
Yeah, and I mean it's really interesting that you should say that, because I think with traditional Azure Blob Storage there are limitations on how you can scale this. It's represented in a metric called IOPS, input-output operations per second. So one of the things that you have to do is you might have to go beyond the volume limit. I mean, 500 terabytes seems like a huge amount of data to store, but not in the world of big data. So you tend to have patterns to allow you to have more throughput and store more data, and that means you have to scale the number of storage accounts out.
Yeah.
So one of the things that Azure Data Lake Storage has brought us is the ability to have a single point of access.
Yeah.
And the great thing about it is that it's got an interface called WebHDFS. So as you can probably imagine by the name, that interface was actually written with the idea of Hadoop technologies in mind accessing this.
Yeah. So we can just throw our stuff in there. We can apply a job to it, turn the cluster off when we want to. We can still access the refined data, the output of our work from other tools, for example, Power BI or whatever it happened to be that we want to use. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And the great thing about this as well is that you can fully automate it. So, we end up in a situation where we can use PowerShell, the new Azure Data Factory, which is a great orchestration tool.
Yeah. And that's really, really super cool for me. This is, and I often get, again, people get a little bit confused about this, and they talk about it. Well, isn't it like integration services? And the answer is, well, no. And I've come from that background, and we've got Alan Mitchell on later, and he used to be a legend in integration services.
He literally wrote the book on it, yes, absolutely.
But now he's gone another way now. He's his stream analytics, and that's what he's going to be talking about later. But if we come back to this a minute, this is an orchestration tool that is controlling our cluster for HD Insight, and indeed it can actually spin one up programmatically and then turn it off when we finish with it, but then it can then run a job inside that cluster, but it will be written, if we're using an HD Insight cluster, in the appropriate language. So it might be an HQL script, or if we're talking to a data warehouse, we might be just calling a traditional stored procedure.
Correct.
And if we're talking to Data Lake, we'd be using a USQL language. So it's a little bit different, but it gives you this one pane of glass where you can see what's happening. If you want to run that job every night or every hour or what have you, it's going to give you that thing. I think it's super, super useful. And of course, PowerShell as well in there. And I think to your data scientist point earlier, we need to learn some JavaScript, we need to learn some PowerShell, we need to learn some R. We might already know C#. So we've now got this kind of multi-purpose kind of scripting guy with some knowledge in some of these tools
to
be able to go and do this stuff.
Yeah. Exactly. I mean, you know, when you break HD Insight down, there's different components of this. You have logging stored in table storage. You have your data stored in blob storage. You have the state of the system. You can attach a SQL database to effectively, if you're going to use Hive, which you mentioned, and HQL, you're going to be creating entities. So things that look like tables in SQL-esque in relational database. So. Mm-hmm. You know, when you do this, every time you create a cluster, you need to have that definition again. And that definition is stored in an external database. So you can just attach that with
back
every new
it.
Cluster, and your state just reappears.
So you can spin it up and spin it down. And I guess this is a play for maybe some organizations that aren't banks or oil companies or the big pharmaceutical boys who have been traditionally using this. It now means that, a smaller retail consortium who has got a lot of data can just flip this on for whenever they need to and then turn it off again.
Exactly. Yeah. And that really brings home the economics and the power of the cloud. And there's a set way of working with Hadoop. You know, you create a job. Each job has a task associated with it. So it's very, it has that familiar distribution model. You apply a schema at execution time. So if you were writing code to define this in C# or Java, you could take a line from a CSV and you could turn that into an object. You can interrogate that. You could type it. You could transform it, and then you could output something different. So then you could focus on being able to put all of these jobs together so that you pipeline them and have what's called intermediate output. So you process, you have a processing step, intermediate output, you process the next step with the data that you've enriched, and that way you can create a veritable pipeline to lead you to that visualization in Power BI. So, we talked about this idea of splitting up and having many storage accounts as a pattern. And
what's a WASB?
Oh, so WASB.
I know what it is. I'm just joking.
Yes.
Yes,
Windows Azure Storage Blob, which actually conflicts with the early version of the service bus, which was Windows Azure Service Bus. So, both team acronyms trod on each other's toes, but this one has stuck longer.
Yeah.
It's still a protocol that's used with storage. Mm-hmm. Now the moniker and the protocol that it's used is ADL.
Yep.
So we can replace the WASB with ADL.
With ADL, yeah.
But it's great because you've got two storages that you could potentially use. Both of them cover different economic implications and different ways of using them. So, you've got variety there.
Yeah.
Secondly.
Okay.
It's worth just expressing that, Microsoft has really invested a huge amount into not only the adoption of Hadoop through HD Insight, but also, contributing to the core Hadoop code base with Hortonworks.
Right. So we're actually changing Hadoop to make it more cloud aware.
Yes.
By putting out our own hooks in, and Hortonworks actually wrote some of that, we worked with Hortonworks to write some of that code in.
So the original Hadoop was centered around this idea of MapReduce.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And we'll talk about that shortly. But what Microsoft did was they helped create an abstraction. So they created a resource manager, Yarn, and then a very pluggable model so that many of the things like machine learning, MapReduce, some of the languages, Pig and Hive, these all just become components that plug into Hadoop.
Yeah.
So it's a much more flexible model now. And this is sort of what MapReduce looks like. It's a very easy way of taking a set of data and then mapping that data into key value pairs. And it turns out that the key value pairs are actually quite easy to distribute.
So you
can create clusters of machines, you can create processes which can then take
sets
of them.
Some sort of sharding mechanism to work out against the key where that particular set of data is on a particular node, on a particular cluster, and then bring it back together at the end. Got that right?
Yeah, 100%. And, it's really a case of, for example, if you were counting if you were counting a set of ages of people, mm-hmm. and you would map those ages, right? You might have a set of data that describes each person, but you might want to just pull out the age.
Yeah.
And it may be of an associated group. So the key in this case could be, by county or something, by county in the UK. And what you might want to do is just count all of the people within certain sets of ages.
Yeah.
So you could either take a key, which was a composite key of the county and the age band.
Yeah.
Or you could take a set of ages against a key with a county, and then you could reduce that down to something else, which would be a count or some kind of aggregate.
Yeah, much, much more than a set of data. Yeah.
Yeah. So so these two things work in tandem. So it's a very, very good pattern. And you can see here from a top-down view, that each of these is individual processes. So you have a map process sitting on a Hadoop node, and then you have a reduce process. And so that's essentially how you can distribute this.
Yeah, and then we're building out these big clusters, and then we have, is it head nodes that sort of overall manage that? And we have a couple of those just in case one dies, so that we can persist state.
Exactly.
So it's a highly available solution.
Yeah, so you've got, you've got this idea of business continuity actually baked into the cluster. And so if we just briefly touch on programming Hadoop, so there's some Java code there, but generally this is what a MapReduce will look like.
Yeah, okay, so if you haven't seen Java before, you don't still need to be a rocket scientist to read this stuff. I can see what it's happening out there. We're going around some sort of loop, we're getting some words out,
Some
comments as well.
And so we're pushing a set of words out. So, if we take this from the top with the map, we're mapping each individual word. We're tokenizing them in the loop, and then when we reduce these, we're just summing these up so that we have
word account.
Exactly.
So we've reduced the complete works of Shakespeare to a list of all the words in Shakespeare with a count, and we can plot that.
Exactly.
So it's obviously a much smaller piece of data at the end of that.
Yeah, and that's just a small piece of code that we can then distribute across the Hadoop.
And I guess the point of this, just pulling back a minute, is that if we take a book, like the one we're giving away here, we might want to do that on it, but then tomorrow we might want to do something completely different. We might have a look at sentence length or something like that and plot that out over the book. We keep the source data, we don't throw it away, but we run a job for a different purpose. And rather than trying to guess for all time what we want to do with this data and put it into some relational structure, each time we're running one of these jobs, we're thinking about it from a different perspective,
Right.
So how many equations are there in there, or whatever it happens to be.
Yeah,
so I think that's quite an interesting point here, that we're doing this sort of schema on demand when we're running this.
Yeah, and this idea of reuse, all of a sudden we can count any number of words in any book.
Any book, yeah, we've written that recipe, we can just throw whatever we want at it, yeah.
Absolutely. So Java is not the only way to interface with Hadoop. We have Hive, which you can see is a SQL-esque type language.
Yeah.
We can physically partition this so that we can increase performance, and we can delimit this. In this case, we've done this by country with our page views table. So we're capturing view times, last referrer tags, the URL for the page. And then we're storing these as a sequence file. So Hadoop has this concept of a sequence file where it goes from 0 to 10,000, and we'll just number these in order.
Right. Okay.
So it's a different file type, and we can also extend this with Java if we want. So you can see here that I've created what's called a user defined function, and then I can just apply this function in SQL. So these are very, very familiar concepts for SQL programmers. Who've been doing these sorts of things for years. So they can just apply themselves straight away to Hive.
Yeah. We're describing the syntax here in JavaScript, and we're using that language because it's more appropriate for dealing with strings and character manipulation and looking for words and splitting out spaces or whatever it happens to be, and then we're able to have a relational structure. And once we've declared that structure, then we can code over it. Yeah,
exactly.
Got the idea.
And there's another way of approaching Hadoop. So one of the things that there's different ways of looking at data, and there'll be SQL programmers that come to Hadoop, but there'll also be people that think about things in steps and sequences that are more used to workflows, and Pig is one such way of describing this.
So we've seen Pig, we've seen Hive, and some JavaScript why have we got three things for doing essentially the same thing? Is this just historical, different communities?
Yeah, so...
Is there a best use case?
So I think it's evolved this way because many companies, for example, Facebook had input into Hive.
And, right.
You know, they took their core skill sets and then they created extensions of Hadoop.
So to work their way. So they changed Hadoop to work the way they wanted to work,
right,
rather than learning how to work the way Hadoop works.
Exactly, because not everybody's a Java programmer. It's not always convenient.
You've got a good friend called Andy who absolutely hates Java, haven't you?
Well, on different days, he's got different feelings about different things. So, you probably caught him on an off Java day.
Okay, off
Java. But you can see you've got a very familiar syntax here. We're dealing with collections in Pig. We can manipulate things, but we can see this as a workflow. So it's not set-based like Hive.
And
we can also do things like unions, and we can iterate these collections, and we can move from variable to variable, and you know, and just enact on on each of these different variables. So it's a way of seeing much of this visually. So we've got a short time left, and I wanted to just draw this to not saying too much about the real time stuff, but
We have a man for that later on.
Yes, we do. But in terms of the open source side of things, there's a couple of frameworks. There's Storm, which we talked about, which is part of HD Insight, and this processes messages using a concept called spouts and bolts. Each message that's processed is processed in an atomic way. So if it gets to the end of its pipeline of spouts and bolts, and you can think of this as like a message router within the cluster. So we can define that route. We can change transform the data as we go along. The spouts themselves, Microsoft have written one for the Event Hub, which is a hugely high performance spout, which can ingest say 4,000 messages a second on each node.
So you can have multiple nodes.
Yeah.
And how many nodes can we have?
Well, you can have as many as you want.
What's the biggest one you've worked on, Richard?
Well, when my credit card ran out. we tend to take it to the limit.
So jolly good. So you phone your wife before you fire up Storm if you're watching this.
Well, not in this case. So I was in the doghouse.
Okay. Okay. So it scales massively. Obviously, you've got to have your HD Insight cluster up all the time if you're going to kind of do this real time scenario. And we'll come back to that later on. But again, you've kind of got spouts going into spouts here. So we've got this kind of initial processing, refinement of processing, working our way through.
Yeah. Exactly. Because I mean, this whole process is about taking data from multiple sources, enriching data sets, joining them, and really getting something better than you started with at the end of the day to give you business value.
Okay.
And there's a couple of simple approaches. You can see that what we just looked at on the screen was called a topology. We can define things like parallelism. We can set the number of workers. We can have a word count bolt here. We can have a split sentence bolt. So we can use this idea of the single responsibility pattern in this.
Wiring functions up together, this loosely coupled. I've just got these off the shelf things, and I'm going to wire them together.
Exactly, and I think that there's a couple of different approaches. You can see that this is some code that actually takes in a bolt, and everything in Storm is a tuple. So we take in a tuple, we emit a tuple, which is just a name value as far as we're concerned. Just to sort of again bring this
Spark,
home, we've got Apache Spark, and Spark is a part of HD Insight now. It runs on this clustered mechanism. It's got a whole load of things to it. It's got a machine learning part. It's got a graph database. It can stream messages in real time, so we can have a micro batch. We can look at a window of data, and we can do analysis over that. We can cache things in this idea of RDD, so resilient distributed data sets.
Oh, right.
One of the benefits here is that we can pull all of our data in memory. So in this case, you can see that we read in a text file, and then we filter. So this is a log, and we're filtering the word anything that starts with error. And then we can split each sentence and take the second part of this. And the second part of the array in this case may be the actual error.
Error message, yeah.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
So all of a sudden we've got a set of error messages, but they're in memory across the cluster. So potentially we could get much faster performance than we can with Hadoop because we don't have that I/O bottleneck. And then, as we go down the line with Spark, we see that actually what the Spark community has done is they've introduced the idea of data frames. you know, which we know from R, we know from Python.
Yeah, I was gonna say,
And, you know, so you can apply a lot of your familiar programming paradigms if you come from these worlds, but you can turn them into a more distributed framework.
Yeah.
So then, if you understand data frames, you can do joins between data frames in memory across this cluster at scale. You know, and this is something that Microsoft has provided literally at the click of a button through HD Insight.
Fantastic. And are you able to, just as we close out, give us a couple of examples of kind of thing? I don't need to know names of who it's for, but obviously I know you guys are out there in industry all the time doing cool things. What are you using Spark for at the moment? Are you able to?
Yeah, of course. So we've written an entire recommendations engine on Spark. So,
right.
Yeah, so we can take in data for 20 million users, 20 million customers. And you know, we can creating heavy cross joins and these sorts of things. There's a lot of computational work, but you know, Spark does this in a hyper efficient way. So, you know, we'll end up with a set of numbers where we can define, you know, the exact products that people should be buying from this.
Across and then that can just be consumed inside their web application. Yeah,
exactly.
Well, Richard, that's fried my brain, I think, and it's only 11 o'clock in the morning.
More to come on that.
more to come on that, because we've got some of your colleagues turning up later to talk to us about this. So do you have a question for us? I think they're supposed to be here.
Yes. So my question is, what are the five services provided by HD Insight?
Okay, what are the five services provided by HD Insight? Get that on Twitter to our team. Prizes in the post. Richard, thanks for taking up your time and your valuable day to come and share your experience with our wonderful Channel 9 audience.
It's been absolutely great, Andrew.
Let's do it again soon, sir. Thank you for your time.
Right. Take care.
Cheers. Bye.